This audio tape by Greg Kokel is one of the resources of Stand to Reason, an organization committed to training Christians to make a thoughtful defense of their faith and values in the public square. We hope this tape will be helpful. Now, here's Greg Kokel.
All right, what we've been doing so far is talking about an idea in our culture. An idea that I think has interfered with a profitable communication on important issues. I think this idea has kept us from being good citizens, good legislators, and good human beings, because it's gotten in the way of profitable discourse on some of the most critical issues. This is an idea that has influenced another aspect of our culture, particularly the religious discourse, and specifically the role that evangelical Christians play in the discussion. There is a mounting sense, at least by some who are in significant positions of influence, that those who are followers of Jesus Christ, called evangelical Christians in the better moments and fundamentalists with a sneer in less charitable moments, are the ones that are really the most dangerous people in our culture. And the reason that they're dangerous is because they think they're right. And it is in virtue of their confidence that the danger is there. Notice that this challenge has really nothing to say about the content of Christian belief. In fact, I have never heard anyone who has raised these kinds of objections talk about the theological content of Christian beliefs, what drive Christians in terms of their foundational ethics or their foundational values. And certainly nothing is said about Jesus Christ except for when he is used as a counterexample to the way Christians are alleged to behave. I don't think this is profitable because it attacks an individual before you've let that individual make his case. And I think the reason that we're like this, the incentive for this, the animus for this, is an understanding about how polite discourse works in our culture, and that is driven by a value called tolerance, which entails an understanding or a commitment to neutrality with regards to individual personal views. That is, true tolerance entails that though we can talk about our ideas on these subjects, particularly religious or moral subjects, we must be very, very careful to qualify our comments or ideas by either implicitly or explicitly saying that we don't really believe these things to be true. These are our, I don't know what we need to be calling them, these are our beliefs. Of course, all beliefs entail truth claims. These are our fantasies, this is our make-believe, and some people actually think that's what religion is. But as long as we put it that way, as long as religious people, not just evangelical Christians, practice their religion in their closet and don't act as if it has any implications for our political life or policy or other people, then we're safe. But the minute we step off our islands of neutrality, then there are problems. But of course, we've just discovered that neutrality is a myth. And if it turns out that this neutrality is really a myth, if I've argued well here, and I've given good examples of this, that in every case when people are arguing against our point of view, the way we traffic with ideas in our culture, that they are actually not neutral either and are promoting a point of view, then nobody's really neutral. And if tolerance, understood here in the postmodern sense, the current sense of tolerance, depends upon neutrality, then tolerance is at risk as well. And I want to continue to argue that point. And in a moment, I'm going to talk specifically about tolerance, but I have one more illustration to show you how this plays itself out in public discourse in kind of a ironic way. About 3 years ago, I was flown out to Toronto, Canada, to do a program on national Canadian cable TV called Test of Faith. Now, in this particular program, they fly out some religious weirdo who sits on a chair behind a semicircle table. It's like a donut cut in half, you know. So you got a small semicircle with a chair there, and you got four other chairs on the outside. And the chair inside the small circle is called the hot seat, and that's where the weirdo sits. And then as the hour goes on, more and more people come out to try to beat up the weirdo on religious issues for an hour on national TV there in Canada. This is what they call fun. So Mr. Kokel was flown out there, and where do you think he was sitting, by the way? He was sitting in the hot seat. He was the religious weirdo. Now, what was my weird religious idea? My unusual religious idea was that I did not believe that all religions led to God. Now, this idea has a name. It's called pluralism. It's the idea that each religion is in itself a legitimate avenue to God. All roads lead to Rome. They all lead to the top of the mountain. You've heard other ways of characterizing this. And, of course, you can see how somebody who holds that view has a pluralistic perspective about religion is completely free to talk about their own convictions, but tempered by this pluralistic point of view, such that you could be a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew, but those were your personal convictions. That was your individual story. That was true for you, as it were, but it certainly didn't have to be true for other people. This is the way pluralism plays its way out, and anybody who holds that view is not going to have any trouble in our culture today in talking about his religion, because they're talking about it in a way that really doesn't have anything to do with anybody else unless they want it to. Now, I don't think that's true. In other words, I think religious pluralism is a false idea, and I was willing to defend that. And I had a very particular way that I was going to argue. Before I tell you what my argument was going to be, before the show started, I was actually behind the scenes talking to some production people. Now, this isn't a religious enterprise. This is a secular program on a religious topic. They just thought it was good TV. They make a few bucks by getting these religious people to beat each other up on TV. So I'm talking to these non-Christians, non-religious. In fact, I was talking to a guy named Pierre who is an atheist. And we were getting along fine. We were having a good chat. And I said, Pierre, let me make a prediction about how this show's going to go. I could be mistaken, but, you know, I've been on these things before, and I've seen this happen before, and here's what my prediction. I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to offer an argument against religious pluralism. Our topic is this idea, pluralism. I think it's a false idea. I'm going to give the reasons why I think it's false. My prediction is that people on the panel are going to ignore my argument, and they're going to attack me personally as a follower of Christ, specifically because I think I'm right. And they're going to call me narrow-minded, arrogant, and intolerant. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but let's just see. That's my prediction. So I get on the air. I'm the first one up. I'm in the hot seat. Valerie Pringles, the talk show host, she begins to question me. The first 10 minutes, we lay the groundwork. I make my case. And I said, Valerie, I'm going to argue a very particular way today. Now, I could argue as a Christian, and I could say that Christianity is true, and therefore other religions are false, and therefore religious pluralism would be false. That would be a way of arguing, and it might have some merit. But I'm thinking, just for your knowledge here, I'm thinking, why should I make Christianity the target when really we're there to talk about pluralism? I don't want to set up Christianity as the target for everybody to shoot at. I don't want to start that way. I had some suspicions that's the way it was going to end, but, you know, I wasn't going to start it that way. No, my strategy was to take, in a sense, offer an argument that was not dependent on any religious convictions. That was really my point. And this is why I said, here's the argument that I would offer even if I were an atheist. So this would work for an atheist or anybody, regardless of their convictions. I'm getting Christianity off the hook. I don't want people to look at that. I want them to look at the issue. And here's my argument, Valerie. I said, Jesus claimed to be the Messiah, allegedly. Either he was the Messiah or he wasn't the Messiah. Now, if he didn't claim it and he didn't exist, then he wasn't the Messiah, right? So you only have two options. He was or he wasn't. Now, if he was the Messiah, the Christians are right and the Jews are wrong. But if he wasn't the Messiah, the Jews are right and the Christians are wrong. But under no circumstance is there any middle ground in which they can both be right. Somebody's right, somebody's wrong. Now, if God exists, maybe he doesn't, but if he does, he's either personal or he's not personal. If he's not personal, the Hindus are right and the Jews and Muslims and Christians are wrong. If he is personal, the Jews, Christians, Muslims are right on that issue and the Hindus are wrong, but under no circumstance can they both be right. When somebody dies, they either go to heaven or hell, they go to astral worlds, they get reincarnated, or they lay in the grave, but they can't do them all at the same time. Now, I think that's a pretty good argument. In fact, I went one further. I said, Valerie, there are two ways that you can beat my argument, and I'll tell you what they are. I said, first of all, somebody could argue that all roads lead to God in the sense that none of them do. Religion's just a myth. It's the opiate of the people, as Marx said, Karl Marx. And so choose your poison, whatever fantasy you want, and they're all equal. That would be one way to go. In that sense, they could be all equal. Another way to go is to say, well, they're not actually all true when you look at the individual principles, but God doesn't care about the details. He just cares that you're doing the best you can and you're following a religion, and that makes him happy. Now, those would be two ways to get around my argument, but do you notice that those two options entail other claims, right? That are rather dramatic claims, and they have to be defended. They can't just be uttered. You have to defend the idea that all religions are false. You can't just say it. You've got to defend the idea that God really doesn't care about the particulars. He only cares that you're pursuing him. I mean, that might be the case, but you can't just fabricate that out of thin air. And in any case, I didn't think the religious people on the panel were going to take those two options. So there I laid it out. First commercial. Come back. First person up was a Sikh. Religious order from India. Gentlemen wear the turbans. He's a barrister there in Toronto. An attorney. Very sharp. Well-spoken. Very capable. He's done many of these things in the past. Written quite a great deal on religious issues. And before the show in the green room, he was quite cordial. But, of course, everything changed when we got on the air. She asked Mr. Singh, what do you think of what Mr. Kokal said? And he starts out rather mild, but mild in a kind of passive-aggressive way. And here's how he started. He said, well, if Mr. Kokal thinks that it's fine. If Mr. Kokal thinks that he won the lottery, oh, good for him. Now, I got to be careful of my Sikh accent, because pretty soon I start sounding like a leprechaun. But what do you mean Mr. Kokal won the lottery? Where did that come from? Had I said anything about a lottery? Had I said anything about winning anything? Have I said anything about being right about anything in my personal religious convictions? Except for the broad thing that pluralism was false. I didn't talk about my religious convictions at all. Not a word. What was he doing? He was changing the subject right out of the gates. He was fulfilling my prophecy. In his passive-aggressive beginning, and he didn't stay passive-aggressive for very long, he was suggesting that there was something wrong with me because I thought I was what? Right. Before long, by the way, he was coming out of his seat and rattling papers at me, and the talk show host had a number of times sit him down because he was so angry. Mr. Kokal's arrogant. Mr. Kokal's narrow-minded. Mr. Kokal's, what's our magic word? Intolerant. He's the kind of person who starts wars. And then one by one, the other panelists came up, a Hindu pastor who was actually more mild, but all roads lead to Rome, that kind of thing. And then a liberal Christian from the United Church of Canada, a woman who said that she thought it was quite arrogant for anybody to suggest they knew the mind of God, and she's shooting sideways glances at me, as if I had said anything about the mind of God. I hadn't. But I wasn't a liberal Christian. She knew that. The irony is not only, she had no sooner said, you know, it was arrogant to say you know the mind of God, than she's giving her own opinion about pluralism, that she thinks that pluralism isn't just an accident, that God had actually created all these different religions as roads to him. This was his idea. So apparently she did know the mind of God. Notice there's no neutrality there, right? She had a point of view. She was right, I was wrong. You know, I made an observation after a little while. I said, it's interesting, we started out talking about an idea, religious pluralism, and I'd offered an argument about that. And so far nobody's addressed the argument. In fact, we've changed the subject, haven't we? We started out talking about this idea, and now we've somehow gotten off the track onto Mr. Kokal's personality. Mr. Kokal's intolerant. Mr. Kokal's arrogant. Mr. Kokal's narrow-minded. Mr. Kokal's mean, you know, I guess is what it amounts to. I said, all right, well, why don't we just all agree for the moment that I'm mean, that I'm a bad guy. Then we can just get on with what we're supposed to be talking about, religious pluralism. And many a times in this discussion, I said, you know, maybe I'm mistaken about my Christianity, which ought not be the topic, but maybe I'm willing to say that. I don't have any difficulty. Some Christians don't like it when I say I could be wrong, but I really believe that I could be. I'm not God. I'm not omniscient. I could make mistakes. Now, as I said earlier, I'm not making it up. I got an argument. I got reasons for believing as I do. I'm not just emoting here, but maybe I'm mistaken. But if I'm mistaken, then that means Christianity is false. And they certainly were implying that I was mistaken, strongly. And if I'm mistaken, then Christianity is false. And if Christianity is false, it's not a legitimate road to God. And if it's not a legitimate road to God, then pluralism is false. In other words, if you're right that I'm wrong, then I'm right about what we're supposed to be talking about today. You see that? They didn't get it. One whole hour, they didn't get it. The atheists got it. In fact, he came up, up on the stage after everything was over and the lights come up, and he said, "Man, I can't believe this. Zeke, what's going on?" And he's using language, appropriate for an atheist. What was he doing? The Sikh was just attacking me personally. He didn't get the argument. The atheist got it. The audience got it. I was calmly arguing that every belief couldn't be true, yet I was the one branded intolerant. The Sikh and the Hindu and the liberal Christian were condemning my Christianity, yet they were the tolerant, open-minded, and accepting people. This happens all the time. But only one side, it turns out the Christian side usually, is called intolerant. The irony is, the Sikh pointed this out, there was a poster outside of the set, in the hallway there at the studio, the soundstage. And the poster said, "You tell me your truth, I'll tell you mine." And so he's invoking this poster against me on the air. And I'm thinking, well, I've been telling him my truth for the last 45 minutes. He didn't like it one bit. What was going on there? It's what we call the passive-aggressive tolerance trick. And I want to show you how to deal with this trick. Once I go through this, you'll see very clearly what the problem is. I know that when I engage in discussion about religious truth, when people call me intolerant, that they are playing a trick on me. Now, they don't know they're playing it. Someone asked me earlier, do this on purpose? Is this a conspiracy of some sort? I don't think so. I think people are socialized in our culture to respond a certain way. And when religious people, particularly Christians, make more objectivist claims about their religious views, they're immediately called this name. You see it on Larry King, comes out of his mouth just like that. In fact, it's a standard way of people dealing with these kinds of issues. And they're socialized this way. They don't know what they're doing. It's a trick. And so I'm going to show you how to demonstrate or how to show what's going on. I'll show you how to fix this. Whenever anybody says that I'm intolerant, I always ask a question. The question is, what do you mean by that? Now, I think I know what they mean. This is a setup. But they don't know what they mean, and I want them to see it. It's kind of a trick, but it's a good trick. It's a fair trick, as you'll see. Generally, people respond like this. They say, "Well, you think you're right." In other words, I'm not what? I'm not neutral. "You think you're right. You think other people are wrong. That's intolerant." Okay, now I know why they've called me this name. Now I have another question. When they say, "You're intolerant," I say, "What do you mean by that?" They say, "Well, you think you're right." And I say, "Well, I do think I'm right. That's why I believe what I believe. If I didn't believe I was right about what I believed, I wouldn't believe what I believe. I believe something else. And so would you. And so would he." Which is why I ask the next question. "Yes, I think I'm right. Maybe I'm mistaken. I don't know, but let me ask you another question. The things that you believe contrary to me, do you think you're right?" Now, what's he going to say? "No, I think all my beliefs are wrong." Ladies and gentlemen, people believe things because they think they're so. To believe something is to hold that it's so. I mentioned this earlier. Now you have more understanding of what I meant. All beliefs entail truth claims. Every single time you announce a belief, you are declaring a truth. Now, it could be you're mistaken about it. and therefore it's not actually true, it's false, but you think it is. And so when I ask this guy, do you, the things that you believe, do you think those are correct? Well, he's got to say yes. If he said no, then I'd have another question. Why do you believe things you don't think are true? No, he believes that they're true. Now, he might say, well, they're true for me. And of course, that's nonsense. He doesn't really believe that. He believes they're true for me too, which is why we're having this discussion, right? He's correcting me, right? So then I close it with this final question. Help me out. Explain this to me. Clear this up for me. I'm confused. Why is it when I think I'm right, I'm intolerant, and when you think you're right, you're just right? What am I missing? I'll tell you something, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not missing a thing. I know exactly what's going on here. And this little questioning thing gets me off the hook, and it gives that other person an education. Because what they probably don't realize is what they've fallen into in this discussion is just rank name-calling. I believe Jesus is the answer to the world's problem. You're intolerant, you're nasty, you're mean. Do you notice how they change the subject? We started out talking about Jesus, now we're talking about me. When you have somebody attacking the person rather than dealing with the issue, there's a word for this in careful thinking, and it's called the ad hominem attack. You attack the man. This doesn't work. This isn't helpful. What if somebody said to me, what if Larry King said to me? I'd love for him to say this to me someday, but I don't think that I'm going to get the chance. But if he did, he said, Mr. Kokel, you're intolerant. And I could say, Larry, you're ugly. And your mother dresses you funny. No, I wouldn't actually say it quite like that. But do you see the point? My question would be, Larry, what would be the difference between what you just said to me and what I just said to you? You attacked me, I attacked you. Neither of us talked about the issue. There is no difference between the two. And what I want people to see is when you challenge other people's views, I should say, to be more precise, when you challenge other people, by attacking their non-neutrality and calling them intolerant, you are not attacking their views. You are not saying anything intelligent. You aren't dealing with their ideas. You are dismissing the ideas and attacking the person. And it is no better than if that person turned around and said to you, and you're ugly. It's exactly the same kind of thing. Your intolerant is not a meaningful or a substantive response. The important thing here is to stop wasting time on name-calling and spending our effort trying to figure out what really is true, for goodness sake. Now, I want to tell you why this kind of thing happens, because people are very confused about what tolerance actually is. About 4 years ago in January, I flew to Des Moines, Iowa to do a series of talks and then to Ames to talk at the university there. And while I was in Des Moines, I had an afternoon off, and one of the local Christian schools got wind of the fact that I was in town. They said, you know, you got an afternoon off. Would you mind coming over and talking to our high school seniors in their religion class? And I said, no, I'd be glad to. And I went over there. And I have to tell you to confess that I'm not usually fond about talking to high school kids. To me, we have a guy, Brett Kunkel, who speaks just to youth. You know, that's his job. To me, talking to high school kids is like talking to a painting, you know. They just sit there, and I mean, I could tell the best joke in the world, and the adults are falling off the chair, and the kids are sitting there like this. Are you going to laugh now? Are you going to? We're not going to laugh. Oh, my gosh. So there they were. They file into the room, and there's one big, like a, you know, long 12-foot table, and they file in behind, and they're sitting behind the table looking at me, about a dozen of them. I mean, it's like the Last Supper I'm trying to teach to these guys. And so what I'm trying to do is to help educate this group of young Christians, seniors, the future of the church, right, on this trick that I'm sure they've been taken in on. And so I ask them about what is the most important notion in our culture? What is the thing that people consider to be the most significant issue? And as we talked, I realized I got it out of them. Yeah, tolerance is the big important value that we promote in our culture. And I knew that they were understanding tolerance in the postmodern sense. So we got the word tolerance, and I wrote tolerance on the board. Then I asked them, okay, tolerance is important, right? Yeah. What is that? What is tolerance? Long time of talking, drawing them out. Finally, we get a definition, and I wrote this on the board. The definition of tolerance, at least in the postmodern sense, is all views are equally valid. No view is any better than any other view. Does that sound right to you? I said to the students. Yeah, we got that. Okay, great. And then I turn around on the board, and I wrote another sentence, and this is what I wrote. I wrote, Jesus is the Messiah, and Jews who reject him are wrong. Oh, them's fighting words, aren't they? Right? And all of a sudden, you know, the Last Supper came alive. And kids are waving their hands. And in fact, a co-ed in the corner here, she's coming out of her chair. And she says, you can't say that. That's, and what do you think she said? Intolerant. And then she says, how would you like it if somebody said you were wrong? Think about it. I said, you mean like you're doing to me right now, young lady? Notice there's no neutrality. I said, it doesn't bother me a bit. Why should it? Now, I want you to observe something about the impact on our culture of this view of tolerance here. This young lady was upset at me. She was upset at me because I said something she didn't like, something she understood to be intolerant. I had the audacity to disagree with somebody else's religious view. She was angry, even though she was a Christian. In other words, this view of tolerance is teaching our kids that they have a right to get angry when someone disagrees with them. Who are you to say? How would you like it if somebody said you were wrong? Doesn't bother me a bit. I'm a grown-up. Then I asked them to consider the words on the board. I want you to think about this. Tolerance, all views are equally valid. I circled that particular statement, and I asked them this question. Is this a view? Yeah. Good. Then I went to the second statement. Jesus is the Messiah. Jews are wrong for rejecting him. I circled that, and I asked the same question. Is this a view? Long pause. Finally, yeah, I guess it is. I said, boy, that's unusual. I looked up at the board. I said, tolerance dictates that all views are equally valid. And then we have this other statement, Jews are wrong for not believing in Jesus, and you say that's a view. Based on your definition of tolerance, what must we say about that second statement? It must be what? Valid. Indeed, just as valid as any other statement. And if you, young lady, get up and are angry at me and are correcting me because you don't like that statement, then based on your own definition of tolerance, what does that make you? That makes you intolerant. I looked at the sentences again on the board. I said, you know, this is weird then. All views are equally valid, including all views that say other views are not equally valid. Or put another way, all views are equally valid and not equally valid at the same time. What do you call that? Uh-oh. Contradiction. This isn't going to work. This postmodern definition of tolerance cannot work. It is contradictory. It's like the tar baby. Every time you try to use it on somebody else, you get stuck on it yourself. That's the problem. This isn't the right definition of tolerance. The definition of tolerance has been changed over the last 20 years. It's been accidental. People haven't done it on purpose. It just somehow got inverted. And I do mean inverted, and I'll show you that in a moment. You see, tolerance is a connotation word. In other words, it's a word that means something, but it has a feeling with it too, like kindness or rape. I mean, these words have feelings about them, or you have feelings about the words. Now, when a connotation word has its dictionary definition changed, oftentimes it still carries with it the good feeling. I think tolerance is topsy-turvy. I think tolerance is now intolerance. That is, the concept of tolerance in the past has been turned completely on its head, and people don't realize it because it still has the word tolerance attached to it, and everybody wants to be tolerant because that's a good thing. But they've been sold a bill of goods. They have bought the wrong definition, and that's the wrong definition. All views are equally valid. No view is better than anyone else. I asked the students, you want to know how to escape the trap? Very simple. You reject the modern distortion of the word tolerance and return to the classical view of tolerance. And then I wrote two principles on the board. And I got these from Peter Kreft from Boston College, at least this characterization of it. The classical view of tolerance has two concepts, and here's the first one. Be egalitarian regarding persons. Now I asked him, do you know what egalitarian meant? No, nobody knew what that meant. I said, well, you see the word kind of equal in there. Egalitarian, equal, think of that. Think of equal or equality. In other words, you treat people equally, that is, with equal kindness and respect. That's the first principle of classical tolerance. Treat every person with equal dignity and equal respect. Then I gave the second principle. And the second principle was, be elitist regarding ideas. Be elitist regarding ideas. I said, you know what an elitist was? Well, they knew what that was. What's an elitist? He's a snob. What's a snob? Someone who thinks he's better than other people. That's right. Now, when you're elitist regarding ideas, you think that some ideas are better than other ideas. Now, why would anybody think that some ideas are better than other ideas? Because they are, for goodness sake. Some are good, some are bad. Some are true, some are false. Some are brilliant, others are foolish. Some are stupid, and some are dangerous. And we ought to have the freedom in our culture to discuss which was which, instead of having anybody silenced with the wrong view of tolerance. Here's the key. True tolerance applies to how we treat people, not how we treat ideas. You treat people with equal respect. And if people hold different beliefs from ours, we still treat them courteously. We still allow them a place in the public discussion. We can strongly disagree with them. That's fine. But tolerance requires us to be civil towards them in spite of our differences. Our commitment to tolerance, which is respect of that individual person, limits the kinds of things we can use against them if we don't like their ideas. Now, there's a reason why this understanding of tolerance got a hold in our culture. It's because our culture was informed by a biblical worldview. And those Christians who had a great influence, and Jews, the Judeo-Christian worldview, principally Christians in this country, but a worldview that is shared by Jews, had a deep conviction that human beings were made in the image of God, and that informed their understandings of liberty and freedom and respect. Ergo, the classical view of tolerance, treat people with equal respect. Now, when it comes to ideas, some ideas are better than others. Reason and intellectual integrity require we treat some ideas as better than others. Any other approach is foolish. It's dangerous even, because ideas have consequences. All ideas are not equally valid. Now, I want you to consider the classical definition compared to the current postmodern definition. The current definition all views are equally valid. The classical definition is all people are equally valid, not all views. What happens when the new definition takes root in society? When ideas become the thing that one must agree are all similar, the same in terms of value? What happens is that the whole classical definition gets turned on its head. Instead of being egalitarian regarding persons and being elitist regarding ideas, the new tolerance says we have to be egalitarian with regards to ideas, and if you don't agree with that, look out, because it's open season on you. You become persona non grata, you become the dangerous person, as we cited earlier. In other words, the postmodern view of tolerance turns the classical view upside down. And if you don't agree with the politically correct ideas, you can be ostracized, you can be punished, you can be fired, you can be forced into special sensitivity programs to make you more tolerant. And I bet you in an audience this size, just in this room, never mind those that are watching on video, that there are people in businesses and larger corporations, because of particular values, commitments that you have because of your religious views, that you have had to go to special training classes to straighten you out, because you're one of the dangerous, intolerant persons and your job required that of you. Now, true tolerance requires something very, very specific. If you look at Webster's New World Dictionary, for example, the word tolerate means to allow or to permit, to recognize and respect other beliefs and practices without sharing them, to bear or put up with someone or something not necessarily liked. In other words, true tolerance involves three simple elements: permitting or allowing, a conduct or point of view you disagree with, while respecting the person in the process. Do you see that according to the dictates of true tolerance, you actually have to disagree with the person and think they're wrong before you can even enter into the arena of genuine tolerance? Sometimes I ask people, do you tolerate homosexuality? Oh, yes. Well, then you think it's wrong. I don't think it's wrong. I think it's just fine. Then you don't tolerate it. You agree with it. Tolerance is only in play, it's reserved for those circumstances when you actually think the other person is wrong. The irony is, under the current definition, it is not possible to tolerate anyone, because the minute you think they're wrong, you're branded intolerant. Well, let me close with this thought. My final reflection is that most of what passes for tolerance today is nothing more than intellectual cowardice, a fear of intelligent engagement. And those who brandish the word intolerant are unwilling to be challenged by other views, to grapple with contrary opinions, or even to consider other views. The reason is it's easier to hurl an insult, you intolerant bigot, than to confront an idea and to either refute it or be changed by it. In the postmodern era, tolerance has become intolerance. And my appeal of you this evening is very simple. Regardless of what your personal convictions are, do not be taken in by the tolerance trick. I mean, be smart. Be responsible. Don't give in to the tendency to dismiss a view with politically correct name-calling like you're intolerant. Rather, address the issues. Consider the facts. Weigh the evidence. Think carefully. Reflect on the reasons. Frankly, there's just too much at stake to put up with this foolishness. And always remember that in the final analysis, when the facts are in, when the smoke clears and the dust settles, when the truth is fully evident, the person that you simply dismissed as intolerant may turn out to be the one that was actually right in the end. but then it might be too late for you. Thank you. Well, we have a bit of time left for final Q&A, and I want to give you a good deal of time to raise your questions or issues that you might have. I'd be glad to answer any of those. So who would like to ask the first question? The gentleman over here on the far side had his hand up first. And if those of you have a question, if you wave and catch Matt's eye, then he can make his way over to you with the microphone while we're answering this first question. Go ahead, sir.
Yes, sir. This concept of egalitarianism of ideas, what I see actually in practice, though, is a speaking of tolerance means egalitarianism of ideas, but a practice 180 from that,
yes,
that it's endorsement of the current set, whatever the current set is, of endorsed ideas by those who have the gun, so to speak, and a rejection or a hostility towards other ideas.
That's right. No, that's a very good observation. In a sense, what you just offered is a summary of my first hour. You've probably noticed this, and this is what I was talking about implicitly the first hour, is that even though there is this idea in play, this ethic as it will, this conviction that some people have at a certain level that all ideas are equally valid, it turns out that they don't actually believe this. Because if you really believe this, you would be neutral with regards to everything else. But indeed, people aren't neutral. Nobody that I read of in any of the quotes that I offered were neutral. Everybody's got their point of view, and everybody who has a point of view thinks he's right. Now, they may have varying levels of conviction about how right they are, but they hold the views that they hold because they think they're right. This is absolutely true. We have a schizophrenic country here where people feel justified with rejecting certain views based on neutrality and tolerance, when in other things they're not neutral or tolerant at all. And usually the dividing line is somewhere along the line of that which is politically correct and that which isn't, unfortunately. And this is quite oppressive. And like I said, doesn't make good citizens, doesn't make good human beings, doesn't further the common good, certainly. And this is why we need to get away from that. And I'm hoping that in this expression, people are seeing, and you are able to see, regardless of what side of the aisle you are on in terms of your spiritual convictions, that, look, everybody's got a stake in the game here. Everybody thinks he's right. Let's use our efforts to figure out what actually is the truth, because I think such a thing is attainable. I think that's within our grasp. Now, I understand that the concept of truth itself is under attack here, and I've done a lot of writing on this, and somebody raised a question earlier in the last session that maybe I misunderstood a bit. I think it was yours, sir, about the objective truth. And I guess to some degree, and maybe this was your point, even to argue against neutrality is to argue that there is objective truth and somebody's got it, and that itself is a controversial notion. But notice that people who argue that the notion of truth is controversial are of the conviction that you can't know the truth. Guess what that is? That's a point of view. That itself is not neutral. So even the postmodern move in this case ends up getting caught in the same trap of non-neutrality. I think that turns out to be some evidence that postmodernism, at least with regards to its view of knowledge and truth, is on shaky ground, shaky legs, thin ice, weak limb, not on solid ground. Mix my metaphors there. I've written about this in other occasions, but I think part of the evidence that the postmodern view of truth, that there is no truth, is not accurate or correct, or could I put it this way, not true, is because when people say there is no truth, they are actually expressing a truth. In other words, they're saying that there is no way the world actually is, and that's the way the world actually is. So they're not able to escape this problem, even if they're of a postmodern conviction. And some people who are postmodernists, think, well, that's sophistry, that's just a word trick. It's not a word trick. This is a serious objection, and it's not going to go away with some hand-waving by postmoderns. It's an attempt to take their view seriously. Do you really want me to believe that there is no way the world really is? And how am I to take that as a statement? I think you want me to take it as an accurate depiction of reality, right? Well, that sinks your ship if that's the case. Next question, in the back.
In this class, when you presented the kids with the postmodern definition of tolerance, and they originally got on board hook, line, and sinker, and then you brought up the statement of Christ, and then you flushed out basically the challenge they had, and then apparently you showed them the tolerance, the classical definition.
Yes.
Did you come to a point, or did they come to a point where they had to choose to drop their belief in the postmodern and accept that what they actually were doing in that class showed they didn't believe in it? What did they do?
I can't tell you what they did. Remember, I'm talking to a painting, by and large. You know, who knows what's going on in their heads? You know, I'd like to think that they got the picture and they changed their mind, you know, but it's these kids, this particular group of kids weren't thinking that carefully to begin with. I thought this is a very clear representation. I hope it found a home and it changed their minds about things, but it doesn't always. I have much more confidence in this audience than in that one. And that what I've given has some handles on it that it will really change your thinking. And this is my hope. My hope is that careful thinking people will realize this isn't going to work. Now, it's not always the case that people are committed to careful thinking. That even when they think they're careful thinking, people are deeply committed to their own views. They have certain prejudices, and sometimes they're just not willing to follow the logic of their views if they don't like where it leads. So I think what I've offered is a good case against the postmodern view of tolerance. In fact, I think it's a devastating case. It doesn't mean that everybody who listens to this is going to buy it, because it isn't just careful thinking that's governing why people believe what they believe. There's a lot at stake here. And people's deepest convictions are at stake here. And I have an axiom I've mentioned many times through Stand to Reason. And that is that people who are very smart and very intelligent sometimes make the most foolish mistakes in thinking when it comes to spiritual things. Somebody, I spoke at a church in the South Bay here in Southern California yesterday morning. After I was done, somebody handed me a printout of a series of arguments from Bertrand Russell against arguments for theism and Christianity. Bertrand Russell is arguably the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, certainly the greatest British philosopher. He's dead now. He was an atheist and a great critic of Christians. It was stunning to see how poor this brilliant man argued against theism and Christianity. He wrote a little book called Why I'm Not a Christian. It's pathetic. And I say that with respect for the man who made wonderful contributions, but this is why it was so bad. He was capable of so much better, and it was awful. I mean, an undergraduate in philosophy could argue against him, Bertrand Russell, on these points effectively. Why did such a great man settle for such bad arguments? Something else was going on. And that's true with a lot of people. If you don't love truth, you're not going to see it when it hits you on the head. You got to have a love for truth. That's a prerequisite. And of course, for the postmoderns among us, it's really hard to love truth if you don't even believe in it. Now, I don't believe that they don't believe in it, but they think they don't believe in it. The fact is, every single person is a truth seeker. We are constantly, moment by moment, every single day, weighing our beliefs and testing them against the world to find out whether they're accurate or not. And in fact, if we couldn't do that effectively, if we couldn't know truth about the world as it really is, we'd be dead in 24 hours, probably a lot sooner. Yes, over here.
Hi. I agree with what you're saying, but
good, let's close in prayer.
We are being hit with this new tolerance weapon every day in school, media, and if we're only hearing the truth once a week, how can we offset that? Because I think if you look at what their onslaught is and how we're trying to get truth out, we're having the yield that we have, which is we're crippled. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, what you're saying is the problem is a huge problem in our culture, and there's a simple answer to it. The answer is simple. The execution is not. If you're a follower of Christ, or if you're not, but you understand the problem that is caused in our culture because of the tolerance trick, then it is your job to take what you've just learned and to communicate it to other people. Not only did I kind of spell out over the time the problem and the concerns and the definitions, but I role played, in a sense, a tool that you can employ to help people see the problem. Actually, there are two of them: the question and answer issue. You're intolerant. What do you mean by that? You think you're right. Well, do you think you're right? Why is it when I think I'm right, I'm intolerant? You think you're right. You're just right. That's one. And the other one is the little illustration I offered on the board, which, with a little reflection, if you took a few notes, you can do it yourself. The notes for the whole talk are available in the back, by the way, if you didn't write it down. Or you can get the CD. But this is not, it isn't that hard when you see it. I've spent 2 hours here helping you see it. I hope if you get it, you realize it's not going to be that hard to play this, play out for someone else the problem. Like I said to the gentleman here, doesn't mean they're going to get it. But if we don't do anything, this will take over. And we and people of any conviction, especially spiritual ones, will lose their right to speak. And I'm speaking very soberly here. It is happening. And if you believe in what you believe in and you think it's important, then you have to deal with this problem before you gain a right to be heard. And this, we're giving a talk like this so that you will have the tools to deal with it. It's a simple answer. It's tough to execute, I understand. But I don't know what choice we have. Question right here.
I'm going to have a hard time articulating this, I think. But you can, even if you get to the point where you can get them to agree that tolerance is not neutral and that they are espousing their own belief system, doesn't it still seem more tolerant to allow homosexual marriage than not? I mean, it's the broad versus the narrow. Isn't it more tolerant to have the broad opinion than the narrow opinion?
Well, certainly on one understanding, you could say, look, if somebody is swearing at me, they say you got really mad at me, you didn't like me. I know that's not the case because we know each other. But you started swearing at me. Could I tolerate what you were doing? Yeah, I think what you're doing is wrong, and I could put up with it. I could allow you to do it. That certainly would be a kind of a noble thing for me to do. Now, it doesn't make what you're doing right. So one could express tolerance of things that are just simply wrong. What if you were beating up your children? Would it be tolerant for me of your behavior to stand by and let you do it? Would that be tolerant? Well, see, now you're equivocating, aren't you? You're not sure. The correct answer is yes, it would be tolerant. But it wouldn't be good. It would be tolerant, but not good. And part of the problem in our understanding and culture is that we have gotten so far away from the moral content of certain actions, and we have got so caught up in tolerance that it's almost like we'll tolerate any behavior, and just in the toleration of the behavior, we're noble and good. It turns out, though, if the behavior is not good for us, if it's not good for society, then tolerating it, though it looks noble, is ignoble. It's misinformed. I actually think on the issue of same-sex marriage, I think that this is harmful for our culture. Now, I have very particular reasons for saying this. I have very carefully worked through the issues. I do not argue based on the Bible. I do not argue based on morality, not the morality of homosexuality. There are moral features involved, but not specifically about homosexuality. So it would be inappropriate for somebody to characterize me as a gay basher because I was against same-sex marriage. I have principled reasons against it that have to do with the well-being of culture and families, and particularly of children. Now, I'm not going to play those details out here myself, but I would be considered probably by some to be intolerant because I'm not allowing same-sex marriage, but that doesn't strike me as a vice if, in fact, my understandings about same-sex marriage are sound. Now, if somebody doesn't think they're sound, they're going to have to deal with the argument itself. They can't simply attack me as being intolerant and think they're going to save the day or hold the day in this discussion. And maybe that's the I think you're right, that if you had same-sex marriage, people would view you as more tolerant, but we don't want to be tolerant of everything, do we? There is a place to be intolerant. We should tolerate people, that is, show them respect, but we don't tolerate all behavior. No civilized society does. We don't tolerate all ideas, obviously, in the sense that we hold them to be valid and legitimate. We tolerate the expression of the ideas, and that's a sign of respect and civility towards the individual. But we can have at the ideas if we want, and that's not violating any meaningful standard of tolerance. Yes?
Do you ever get any logical arguments against what you presented tonight?
Do I get any logical arguments against what I presented tonight?
Other than just the ad hominem attacks.
Well, the simple answer is no. And what I was tempted to say, and I know this may sound a little bit odd, or, you know, maybe self-serving, but I don't know what people would say against it. It is, to me, I made a logical case. The case was that the notion of tolerance that's being promoted right now is self-contradictory, therefore it's incoherent and can't be true. Now, I am trading on a very basic principle of logic, the law of non-contradiction. If somebody thinks I'm mistaken, they're going to have to either show that I've misapplied the principle, or they're going to have to overturn the law of non-contradiction, which ain't going to happen. Now, I'm very interested in hearing anybody's principled objections against the case I've offered, but I really don't know what they could be. This isn't rocket science. It just isn't. Doesn't it seem as plain as the day is long once I spelled it out for you? I have talked to some people that, actually, there's a woman at Lewis and Clark College, the second most liberal college in the United States, according to one poll. They're very proud of that. And I got to speak on their campus for an event once. And we were talking about these things broadly. And one of the faculty who was speaking didn't like the idea that tolerance was putting up with things you didn't agree with. She didn't like that. She didn't like the notion of putting it up with it, because it sounds condescending. Surely we could do better than that. But the fact is, that's what tolerance is. We don't agree with everything that people say and do. We don't stop the expression of it or the activities in every single case. And when we don't agree with it and instead put up with it, that's called tolerance. I mean, you can't make it go away just because you don't like the way it sounds. I mean, that's as close as I got to an objection. But again, I invite anybody to offer a principled objection against this analysis. I'm certainly capable of being mistaken, but I haven't seen the argument yet. Question over here. Yes.
We have an old saying. It's don't shoot the messenger. And basically, that's what's happening here. We're a messenger giving our ideas, our truth, or our beliefs, and they're shooting us.
Yeah.
They're not even addressing the message.
The issue itself, right.
And, I mean, to look at it broadly, this could only be an agenda to tear down what I would think is our, as a United States, as we stand as a pillar for the world, and all these things are coming against it, and they're using this argument literally to tear it down. Am I wrong, or am I?
Well, I don't see this in terms of an attack on the United States. This is something that's going on within the United States, and it has to do with a very, very real, palpable battle on values. And there's a strategy from one side, a technique that's being used in the battle of ideas, and that is to dismiss the idea by attacking the person. Now, this is an ad hominem. It's not to the point. It doesn't work. But it is the technique of choice now. Look at I don't actually like following political things because, you know, I listen to these discussions and I just get angry. Because the most common way to deal with ideas that people don't like, even from educated politicians and legislators, congressmen, senators, is to call names. Do guilt by association. I mean, it's just thick with informal fallacies, and it's very seldom that people get to the point. And so it just drives me nutty. Part of this is because thinking is not esteemed. Careful thinking is not esteemed in this country. We are not taught to do this. We don't know how to do this. And it's too much trouble. We are governed by images, and a culture that's governed by images is very easy to manipulate. And what I've offered here this evening is just some, I think, fairly basic reflections using critical thinking skills that uncovers a bunch of nonsense. And I think if we were taught better about this, we wouldn't be taken in by it. I don't think it's a conspiracy, but I do think that there is this values thing going on. And I even though religion is popular and spirituality is popular in this country right now, I mean, certain types of spirituality are better than others. And people have never liked the idea that they were morally culpable for their crimes against God. Now, that's just a fancy way of saying they're sinners. This is an offensive message. But it's the thing that Jesus focused in on. I was on, you know, Hannity and Combs, Alan Combs, the liberal. I was on his radio show a couple years ago, and he wanted me to argue that Jesus was a conservative because he thought Jesus was a liberal. And he had a lot of, I mean, no disrespect, but he had a lot of silly ideas about why he believed this. To show you I'm not meaning disrespect, I'll give you his first idea. Jesus said he came to, watch it now, liberate the captives. If he's a liberator, that means he's a liberal. That's almost exactly how Alan Combs did it. That's silly. That's silly. But he wanted to make the point that Jesus was all about serving the poor. Jesus wasn't about serving the poor. He was about serving the poor in spirit. There is a big difference. The reason he spent time with the poor is because the poor, financially poor, were also poor in spirit. But anybody who is rich, who is poor in spirit, like Nicodemus or Joseph of Arimathea, he welcomed them too. It was usually the downtrodden that were more aware of their sinfulness than those who were the leading aristocracy, the ruling aristocracy. Jesus cared about the sinners because he came to save sinners, the ones that were spiritually sick, not the righteous. He said that explicitly. That's the message that's hard for people. And by the way, in their more candid moments, and I think I have a memory back here somewhere that I think even Bertrand Russell made this comment, but others have as well. They said, I'll tell you what's really going on here. I don't want anybody telling me what I can do, who I can sleep with. Therefore, they're against the God, any God that says so. And that certainly would be the God of Christianity. Now, I am not dismissing their arguments based on their motivations. That would be a fallacy, genetic fallacy. But I think their arguments are bad. And then it causes me to wonder, well, why would they believe what they believe if their arguments are so bad? Something else is going on. And something else is going on. People have a moral problem. And if the moral problem is what's driving things, they'll buy this tolerance business, even if it's nonsense, because it justifies their rejection of a moral view that they don't like. It makes them comfortable in it. Now, I realize this, I'm off into psychology now, but I'm not making my argument based on psychology. I think something's going on here. And that's why we have this schizophrenia, you know. Everything's neutral, except for my views. My views aren't neutral. They're right, and you're wrong. But I'm tolerant, and you're not. It's nonsense. That make sense? I think that would be my assessment. People do not want to bend the knee. It's the hardest thing for anyone to do. And we will fight to the grave and beyond so we don't have to do that. That's a very high price to pay for eternity. Right? Yes?
I've spoken to some people before, and they espouse this viewpoint.
This is going to have to be the last question.
Very good.
I just looked at my watch. I realized
it's a good one. They have espoused this viewpoint of all views are equally valid, which is, you know, I mean, almost like shooting yourself in the foot, and you realize it. But I've sort of gone over the top, and I've said something like, well, then you agree with what Hitler did was okay then. maybe, you know, I'm just, that's how my, that might be right. A little bit too much in their face because then after the,
no,
like,
it's
what
a fair
mean?
Counterexample to what yeah. they're saying. I think it's absolutely fair. Part of the problem with using Hitler is a lot of people will bite the bullet and say, yeah, you're right. He mm-hmm. was within his rights.
But you think that would be a better tack or maybe saying something like, you know, why would you believe something like that?
Well, it's always fair to ask that question, why do you believe something like that? You're trying to get the rationale, and that's part of the Colombo tactic, which I know you're familiar with. Well, what we suggest in the relativism book, yeah. Relativism Feet Firmly Planted in Midair, is that an effective tactic is to push their hot button. In other words, to find out what the person's strong convictions happen to be with regards to morality and then relativize that. When I first started doing debates on relativism, actually the very first formal debate I did was 6 days after 9/11. And this was so fresh in people's mind, and their nerves were so raw with this blatant attack on American soil, killing almost 3,000 people, that I could hold up here in a debate with a professor, Magliocco, over at Cal State University Northridge, who is defending moral relativism. I'm defending moral objectivism. I could hold up a front page edition from a few days before, which called the bombings evil. And this would resonate with the whole audience. And so I had a leg up right out of the gate, because what Professor Magliocco was going to have to say is that this wasn't evil, it wasn't good, it wasn't anything. We define it evil from the perspective of our culture, they defined it good, and that's as much as you could say about it. Now, she was dead going out of the gates. But I did that 2.5 years ago, or a year and a half later, at Oregon State University. I fell right on my face because enough time had gone by that people not only were emotionally removed from the event itself, but they had been politicized about the war in Afghanistan and what looked like a buildup for Iraq, and they are now resistant. And I realized it didn't work. So what I've done since then is I've used examples like Matthew Shepard, the homosexual young man who was beaten terribly in Montana or Wyoming or one of those cowboy states, and from guys at a bar and strung up on a barbed wire fence overnight where he died. Now, what do we make of that? Now, see, notice that this is gay bashing. This is homophobia. This is a politically correct concern. This is what those guys care about. I just relativized it. I push their hot button, and I relativize it. And I use those kinds of examples. Now, find out what they care about, and then apply their rules to it, relativizing that, and then see where they go with it. Torturing babies for fun is a standard illustration, but even Professor Magliocco balked at that. In fact, I've had two people tell me directly that they didn't think torturing babies for fun was an objective moral harm. And one was the illustration that Matt mentioned earlier. And a second one, when I was on KFI with Barbara Whitesides, and she bit the bullet and said, well, it's not wrong to torture babies for fun, instead of making an objectivist moral claim. So that's the kind of nonsense that's going on. And I hope that what I've offered you in our discussion today is some clarity on a very important issue that touches not just followers of Jesus Christ, but every citizen of this country. And I hope what I've given you is some tools that will help you to think more carefully about these issues and therefore come to more accurate conclusions about things that really matter. Thank you very much.
For more Stand to Reason tapes or resources, contact the store where you purchased this tape or call toll-free 1-800-2 and the word reason. That's 1-800-273-2766.